Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey guys, you ever wonder what Phil and I wear while we podcast? You can find out if you join our Patreon. We'll also be talking about the films of 1989, but that's definitely less important than seeing our Zoom backgrounds, our headphone choices, and our sweatshirts.
It's true. It's true. You'll get to see all the various pieces of artwork that I have framed on my office wall, and you can see Kenny's garden, sort of. So that's something. That's exciting.
It's a hanging garden.
It's a hanging garden. But perhaps more important than anything, we are doing this Patreon to cover the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, with amazing guests like Tom Meissen, Liz Hanna, Joanna Robinson, Brian Cogman, Chuck Hayward. You can sign up at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. And for $5, you'll get access to all the audio of these fantastic episodes. For a few bucks more, you'll get video as well of our 99 and 89 episodes. And perhaps, most importantly, you'll be supporting us so we can just keep making podcast content for you guys.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 from a bathroom floor here in 2021. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Phil Iskov.
And back for the third time, the fourth time, I'm not sure. Back, it's Tom Lorenzo from the You're Missing Out podcast, our brother podcast. It's great to have you back on.
It's great to be back. I'm back and better than ever.
Back and more corrupt than ever.
The most corrupt. Baby.
The most corrupt. Tom, you've been doing a lot of tweeting recently about this mosh pit you've gotten into and the punch in the face you received. Tell us a little about that before we get into the corruptor.
We got so much to talk about with the corruptor.
What's in the news?
I just went to there's a bar I go to that. The punk bar that with karaoke that you said you wanted to come.
I immediately said I can't wait to hang out with you.
So I went there one day and it was kind of dead. And I know the bouncer. I kind of bounce with him when I'm there. There's a story from yesterday that I had to help him bounce something. He's like, there's an emo night at another bar. I went, big crowd, crazy. The mosh was there was a pit going. I jumped in. But I noticed all the guys were getting a little too hectic. And there was just like this section of like just women that were like getting fucking hammered by these guys going too hard. So I just stepped in and I just kept grabbing them and throwing these guys back into the pit and preventing all of these fucking girls from getting leveled by these, let's say rotund white boys from Long Island. Some Woodstock 99 Denisons.
Some Rotundos.
That's yeah, I watched amazing. The Woodstock 99 doc, and I was like, oh, I was there last week. Yeah.
Yeah.
You guys doing that, by the way? I forgot to ask.
Yeah. We're going to cover 99, yeah, for
yeah,
sure. Well, Woodstock 99. You know, speaking of problematic things, this film's pretty problematic.
Why is there a central star that's got issues with the Asian American community?
Yeah. I really didn't know much about this movie. Kenny just hit his face. I didn't know much about this movie when I hit play. Like, I knew who was in it.
Yeah.
And I think in my brain, I kind of blurred it with The Replacement Killers, which was the first Chow Yun-Fat movie that came out stateside.
Yeah.
Me too.
The superior film to this. Yeah. And I don't even really think Replacement Killers is all that good. But but I had no idea how, I guess, entrenched this movie is in Asian culture. And a misrepresentation of it. It's a crazy, crazy movie. A real moment in time. This movie would never, ever get made today. Not by the people that made it anyway.
Not by the people that made it. And the guy's too busy making a 50 Shades sequels to get back to such high art like this the character.
Poor guy.
Yeah.
The guy made Glengarry Glen Ross, one of my favorite movies. But I think the problem is, like, it's not – this is the big – I think the main issue with this movie as a whole is that he's like a good workman director.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And this movie's taken kind of a big swing tonally that you need someone to either hone in on one tone or a director that can handle the crazy shifting thing that's going on with this movie. Because it's like
It's clearly, I mean, obviously, stylistically, there's a lot of ripping off of John Woo to some degree or another. I mean, just in terms of sort of this very overly active camera, let's just say.
And even the action, they do the two guns thing. They do a lot of jumping across rooms and stuff. They just don't cross the line and say, all right, we're not going to do doves. We'll keep the doves. doves away. Yeah. That's like the plagiarism lines, like just plagiarized enough that you can't sue.
But needed the doves.
I agree.
But, right? Yeah, that's the thing that I would always take from Wu is the doves and everything they represent, right? Because then you're out of this garbage water world that we're like kind of drowning in throughout this movie, and you're brought to some other plane of existence where this all kind of makes a little more sense. But as there is this, we talk about the Uncanny Valley all the time in terms of CGI and stuff like that. But there is an Uncanny Valley in this movie in terms of what am I supposed to believe is going on here?
Yeah, so, I mean, on one hand, it's trying to be John Woo, but on the other hand, it's like trying to be like the French Connection or something, like a gritty cop
movie. The Departed is what really hit me. I was watching it.
Definitely The Departed,
Where I was just like, it's so convoluted in its story. Like the plot
just
of this
like
movie.
The Departed.
No, but truly, there's so much double crossing and people that are, you know, doing shady things that you're so lost. I was so lost by the end of like, who has an allegiance with anybody at this point?
It was a little, I mean, I'll give them, I think it was a good moment when you find out that Wahlberg is an informant. Because I really wasn't expecting that. Because, I didn't know anything about this movie, so I didn't know what to expect. Like, I didn't have any preconceived, like, oh, okay. I thought it was going to be a bit of a training. This is kind of Training Day.
Yes, it was like Training Day.
This is proto-Training Day, 2 years before that came out.
And Ethan Hawke was supposed to star in this, too. He was supposed to be the Mark Wahlberg lead, and then the scheduling got fucked up.
I mean, Mark Wahlberg is absolutely the big anchor on this movie. I mean, second to the director, not to like really like assault James Foley or anything. Yeah. Like I said, I love Glengarry Glen Ross.
Yeah,
Fear's pretty good, but Wahlberg is not the guy.
No,
you get to play the innocent, doe-eyed cop with dorky the daddy cop. Issues.
They put, they put glasses on him at the beginning, and you're just
every
like, come
time
on
you
now.
Put Wahlberg in glasses. You're making a mistake, or you're doing like, or it's like Transformers 4 where Michael right. Bay is doing it
you're
as the
fun.
Joke.
Yeah. This is before Wahlberg really figured out who he is and who he can be.
Yeah.
But all right. So the obvious Chow Yun-fat, as he's dying, says, "Who sends a white cop undercover in an Asian community?" And that seems,
which isn't supposed to be funny, but it's funny.
It's all right. So that's there you go. You know what the problem is. So now you guys know how to fix it, right? If obviously the fix, this is a significantly more interesting movie. It's so obvious. It's Donnie Brasco. If it was an Asian cop, it's so obvious, like where you can start with this film. So the fact that, you know, I understand, you know, for racism reasons why they went with the white cop, for, you know, the ideas of not wanting to have two Asian action stars starring in an American movie, et cetera, et cetera. But the movie's doomed from the start. It didn't do well. No one wanted to see it. No one cared about these two guys together. No one really knew what to do with Wahlberg at this point.
Nope.
And it was just a kind of a miserable experience in a lot of ways.
Yeah, because this is what this is the same year as Three Kings, right? Three Kings is
this is the same year as Three Kings. I'm pulling up his filmography right now,
And nobody gets Wahlberg better than David O. Russell.
Agreed.
Well, because it's like his career at this point, he's got like three pretty big highs of Boogie Nights, Fear, and Three Kings in 99.
Mm-hmm.
Then he's also got shit like this, and he's the in the Replacement hit. Killers, right? Or no,
the
he's
big,
in the big
hit is not shit. The big hit is good.
I feel like when we did Three Kings, Kenny fought for Big Hit.
We talk about the Big Hit comes up every once in a while. Like the Big Hit is fun and silly, and like it's almost like a spoof. This is dead. This is dead serious. This movie,
well, but also sometimes not.
Sometimes
it's interesting
not.
Though. Like
Brian Cox doesn't think it's serious.
This is true. Tom, you make a good point. Like, he's got Fear, he's got Boogie Nights. The Big Hit was, by the way, a successful movie. The Corruptor, Three Kings are both in 99. And then he does The Perfect Storm in 2000, right? And this is when, like, him and his agents are like, we have a movie star. And he gets over his skis. He does Planet of the Apes. He does Rockstar. He does Truth About Charlie. And that's kind of when, like,
what a delectable like triple wheels, feature.
Where the wheels are just coming off the wagon, right? Then he does Italian Job, which gets him back on, you know, and sort of then it's Four Brothers and Invincible, Departed. Like, then he's figured himself out. But there's this moment there, to your point, Kenny, about like this movie not understanding Wahlberg. Hollywood, and I would argue Wahlberg, doesn't really understand Wahlberg for a little while there, for like the better part of 3 years.
Five.
I mean, we're back in... They don't know what to do with Wahlberg mode. I mean, it's been a few years since I've liked him in anything. And I like Wahlberg, like, as an actor, you know. Like, there's when he's on, like, in Boogie Nights and Three Kings and, you know, The Departed, Huckabees. You know, Huckabees. Yeah. I mean, when he's being used right, I really like him. But seeing him, like, just floundering and shit, like, Infinite and, you know, it's just like...
I didn't see Infinite, but yeah.
It's disappointing.
What was the last?
You know?
I mean, I liked the double feature that he did in 2016, the two Pete Berg movies, Deepwater Horizon and Patriot Day.
You
I
did?
Actually like those movies.
I thought those were really good. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I thought those movies worked.
Yeah, those are good.
But that's the last time he's been good. Yeah.
But to your point, like with not knowing Wahlberg, he's the worst thing in Patriot's Day. He's good in Deepwater Horizon, but he's the only one in Patriots Day where you're like, oh, he's an actor. Like, this feels like a docudrama thing, and then it's just him. Just like, why is he even here? Yeah, honestly, I'm looking too. That's literally the last time he's...
Kenny, we talked a little bit about Wahlberg on Three Kings, but I don't know if we honed in on this question, and I'm curious as to your thoughts on it. Is there an actor that you can think of that is... whose lane is maybe so specific and yet so lucrative? Like, there's not a ton of range to Mark Wahlberg, and I'm not going to sit here and just rag on him, but do you know sort of what I'm getting at? Like, it's very narrow.
I Look, I disagree with you. Okay. But I don't disagree with you. I don't just disagree with your point about not a lot of range. I don't think there is a lot of range. I agree with that. But I think his character is very adaptable.
Yes.
So to a lot of different genres, right? Like, I think that he was the perfect guy for Ted. I think he's really good in Instant Family, which I watch with my kids, which makes no sense, but he works there. He works in Daddy's Home really well.
The Other Guys, and sure.
The Other Guys, he works really well. Pain and Gain, he works really well. And again, he's not too far outside of his, you know, his guardrails.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly enough, the times he's gone outside of the guardrails, I think he's been really good. Like, I Heart Huckabees is one of his best performances. And I think, I think you know that The Departed is one of my three least favorite movies.
You love
The Departed. But even after coming out of that movie, I said Wahlberg was the only part that I thought was any good. So I loved him in that movie as well. You know, I think every few years, maybe every 2 years, every 3 years, if I'm looking at his filmography, his agents or maybe his manager, who I know very well, might say, let's see if we can get Wahlberg that Oscar. He's been nominated twice, which is insane.
Sure.
So he does movies like The Gambler, which was a disaster.
Is coming up this year.
And then All the Money in the World was 17, and then Joe Bell is this year. And, you know, like, for whatever reason, Hollywood seems to be pro Wahlberg, right?
Like, for whatever reason.
But more than even most people. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Like,
totally.
More than even most people. Like, it's crazy that a guy like Mark Wahlberg could ever be in Oscar conversations after all the weird shit he's done and all the bad stuff he's done. And Joe Bell, like, is very clearly, you know, it sounds like it's not the movie that people hoped it would be. But it also sounds like people are like, but Wahlberg's the right guy for it. You know?
I think his big problem is when he tries to be cool. But the big failures are when he's trying to be cool, stoic, action guy. Or like, I'm a tough, like, badass, and he doesn't have like a moat or anything. But then but when he's earnest, or when he's playing a guy who's dumb, or a guy who doesn't realize he's dumb, like in Pain and Gain.
Yeah.
Great.
He's great.
That's
his best lane. Mm-hmm.
That's the thing I was thinking about watching this movie, is I'm genuinely surprised he was never in a Coen Brothers movie or like an Elmore Leonard movie about these guys that always think they're smarter than they are, but in the end they're just the biggest fucking idiots in the world who got in too deep.
He would have been perfect in Out of Sight or something like that. You know what I mean? Like,
he would have been great. And like, if Steve Zahn was busy, he could have been that guy.
Totally.
If they like rewrote it to be the Boston Mob, he could have been Don Cheadle's role. You know?
Yeah.
And it's interesting because that was his early career. That's who he is in Boogie Nights, and that's who he is in Three Kings. And those are the two best directors he's ever worked with, and those are, you know, two of our better directors anyway. And they really seem to understand that lane you're talking about.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, it's why he's nowhere
in this movie. It's why
I'll say the other thing. I mean, the other good director he's worked with, I guess, is Martin Scorsese. And the other thing about him in The Departed is that is the only time when I buy him as an in control alpha. And part of that is because he's playing it so big.
Yeah.
You know, it's not because it's not so much about being cool. It's more about being right and smart and half a step ahead. And in the right movie and in the right role, he can pull that off. What he's not, and I think we're kind of hitting this.
Yep.
He's really not who he looks like, right?
Yeah.
He's not the football team captain.
Yeah.
And that'll never work. But like, you know, who is?
Sorry, go ahead, Tom.
No, I was just gonna. Yeah, he's basically kind of trapped in a leading man's body, but he's best as like a character guy.
Yeah,
you know, just supporting, being a doof. When his voice rises, and he doesn't understand the question or something, it's just like, yeah, that's great. Like watching Ted. Ted was on TV the other day, and I'm just like, yeah, he's like giving a legitimately great comedic performance in this, opposite a fucking talking teddy bear. Like, that's not an easy thing to do.
I would say, though, it can break the other way, too. You know, you can see The Happening, for instance, where he spends that entire film in a higher register, and it does not
He's supposed to be smart, and that's a straight role. That was a big mistake.
Big mistake.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is also just, I think that this movie just falls early in his career when he's, you know, they just kind of slot him in there. I'm going to give a synopsis real quick. Martial arts expert Detective Nick Chen, played by Chow Yun-fat, teams up with his colleague Danny Wallace, played by Mark Wahlberg, to keep several gangs in New York City's Chinatown from annihilating each other. They must contend not only with the increasingly power-hungry gangsters, but also with the temptation of bribery and corruption as the bad guys divide and conquer the police forces. In what's beginning to seem like a losing battle, Chen and Wallace struggle to establish law and prevent more bloodshed. The Corruptor opened on March 12, 1999, in fourth place against Analyze This, Cruel Intentions, The Rage, Carrie 2, and Wing Commander. It would go on to make $24.5 million on a $25 million budget. It's got 48% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 43% from audiences. Roger Ebert gave the film 1.5 stars, said even when it's transplanted to the streets of New York's Chinatown, as The Corruptor is, the Hong Kong action genre has certainly obligatory requirements. Low angle shots of bad guys looming over the camera, for example, and the sound of a metallic whoosh when there's a quick cut from one scene to the next, and what seems like more dialogue during action scenes them before and after them. The director is James Foley, who's obviously not right for this material. It's a shame, actually, that he's even working in the genre, since his gift with the intense study of human behavior and his best films include Glencairn, Glen Ross, At Close Range, and After Dark, My Sweet John Woo, who might have brought more crackling energy to this material, especially if he nixed the casting of Wahlberg, wouldn't have been right for Glencairn. So there you are. I mean, we've been doing this now, Kenny, for, you know, almost 4 years. This is the shortest Ebert review I think I've seen thus far. I think it's 3 paragraphs, maybe 4. Yeah. Like, he's just like, I'm not wasting my fucking time writing this. Like, why even bother?
You know what? I think if Wu directed this, he might have gotten something out of Wahlberg.
Maybe.
Yeah, because he would have overheated this movie. Like, that's Wu's thing. It's cranking everything to 11.
Yeah.
And I think he could have got something out of Wahlberg. Because, I mean, shit, he did it with Slater in Broken Arrow.
It's true.
I mean, he pushed Tom Cruise to the limit in Mission Impossible 2. Like, there's moments in Mission Impossible 2 where you could see Tom Cruise struggling to keep up with the melodrama of the scenes. It's the funniest shit in the world, where Tom Cruise is like, I'm drowning in this movie. I love Mission Impossible 2. But
I was just
so
gonna
funny.
Say that's why I'm a little. I mean, I've always been confused. Why the Mission Impossible heads,
yes,
who I hate.
Well, you talk hate the about, series.
I hate the series, but I think 2 is like underrated.
It is underrated.
And I think part of that is, for me, I guess I want something different out of my action movies than all these people on Twitter who just want Tom Cruise to nearly die. Which is what I can't really tell what else they want out of these films. I think they want Tom Cruise to almost die.
I think the reason people don't like Mission Impossible 2, for what it's worth, is all the reasons why you guys probably like it, which is that it's not really a spy movie, right? Like, it's just not.
It's a Hitchcock movie.
I mean, it's a Hitchcock movie. It's a straight up action movie. Like, it's just this kind of,
and coming after a De Palma movie, you know, like so many people kind of get their fucking hackles up over De Palma, and it's like, you know, it's that thing of the series isn't the series yet. So, this second one's such a 180 from the first one, and everyone's like, what the fuck is the series even?
Right.
But nobody makes movies like John Woo. I mean, he basically made To Catch a Thief with Tom Cruise and Tandy Newton and just cranked the fucking melodrama up and just the two guns and just motorcycles flying at each other. It's glorious.
I think the dumbest shit in the world,
and I love it.
I think that's what I'm getting at, too, which is, like, in general, action movies as a genre are absurd.
Yep.
And I've said this to you, that, like, what makes an action movie, Phil? It's if it's the kind of thing that would be reported in the news if it happened in real life, it's an action movie, right? And otherwise, it's a drama. So, like, you know, and in this movie, I don't really know what's going on in this movie that would be reported in the news, but, like, it's kind of irrelevant. The point is, you're already so far past the realm of believability. I've always liked making it more, making it everything, using everything at your disposal. And that's probably why the movies that bore the shit out of me more than anything are like the Bourne movies bore me to fucking tears. The Mission Impossible After 2 bore me to fucking tears. Like, they're just so terrestrial. Not in terms of like literally terrestrial, but just in terms of, you know, everything kind of fits together in a way where like, this is actually how things work with international espionage. Ugh, I couldn't care fucking less. Give me Taken, you know?
Okay. Well, I mean, be that as it may, I do think that, I mean, I if you don't like spy movies, you don't like spy movies, right? Like, if you don't like espionage movies, you don't like espionage movies. And whether or not they have Tom Cruise jumping out of a plane or, you know, what have you is moot ultimately.
I don't mind spy movies about spies. I do mind something that – I do mind action movies – like spy – action movies that are undergirded in the spy genre. Which, what I'm trying to get at is like, pick a lane, right? Spy espionage is not about kicking ass all the time. Like, I love the Americans, right? And the Americans is, you know, six season spy movie.
It's not even about kicking ass. I mean, John Le Carre stuff is what real.
That's what I'm getting at. Right. I because, you know, I love heists and I love the intricacies of process. But when you get into this Jason Bourne human weapon thing, you better have a lot more fucking fun with it at that point, right? Well,
listen, I like the Jason Bourne movies, but I haven't rewatched them. I think those are going to kind of age like shit, to be honest. I mean, what they did to action cinema with the shaky cam stuff is enough to send it to the fucking Hague.
But
I don't disagree. I guess my point ultimately would be that I don't know that it needs to be this binary. I think that a good spy movie can have action, and I think a good spy movie doesn't necessarily need to have action.
Of course, right. I just haven't seen it.
My platonic ideal of the action spy movie is Casino Royale.
Great movie.
Because it has that tactile, it feels like the Fleming books, where it feels like, okay, this guy knows what spy craft is, but he's juicing it a little bit to give you like, well, you're at a movie, like we're going to watch a movie. Like, you're not going to, most spies aren't getting into machete fights with African warlords with Eva Green next to them. But you give it enough realism, you get enough of the spy craft, then you're cooking with gas. But the corruptor.
I want to just for a second, and I texted this to you, Kenny, yesterday as I was watching The Corruptor, because I you know, periodically I look at the studios that make a movie and look at their output for the year. We've talked a fair amount about MTV films. We've talked a little bit about Fox 2000. New Line Cinema's 1999 output was Blast from the Past, The Corruptor, Austin Powers, Spy Who Shagged Me, Drop Dead Gorgeous, Detroit Rock City, The Astronaut's Wife, The Bachelor, and Magnolia. That is a very strange batch of movies.
It's a good year.
That's a pretty good year. No, that is a pretty good year, to be honest. And in 99, they're starting on filming Lord of the Rings.
They are, exactly. I guess the lows are very low. The highs are very high, I guess, is what I'm getting at from this output. Like, Kenny and I can, I think we can safely say Detroit Rock City, Astronaut's Wife, and The Bachelor are three of the worst films we've covered in 1999.
Yes, terrible films.
So I mean The Corruptor is not that far ahead of them, I would assume. But you know, you look at Magnolia and Drop Dead Gorgeous and even Blast from the Past to a certain degree, and those are swings, and I respect the hell out of them getting behind them, and obviously we're big fans of Magnolia and Drop Dead Gorgeous and Blast from the Past on this pod. But I guess I'm just trying to get at, New Line Cinema is a fascinating beast as a company. They've made some of my favorite films. But they also make trash. Like, it's kind of amazing, their spectrum.
Yeah, I mean, because this is when they're starting to shift. I mean, the fact that they're starting filming new Lord of the Rings at this point is they're starting to make that big push. Because, I mean, they're referred to as the house that Freddy built. I mean, they're the guys that they made Freddy Krueger. That was their first big thing. Before that,
really,
Robert Shea was like, he was a distributor. He was just picking up movies and literally throwing the film cans in his trunk and just driving around New York, delivering them to theaters. know, and then he hooks up with Craven, makes Nightmare, and from there they're making shit, and they're an ostensibly B movie outfit, and a lot of them are great. I mean, shit, one of their B movies just got inducted into the Criterion Collection. Deep Cover is in there, and Deep Cover is a great fucking movie. I watched it the other day, and I missed the New Line look of the 90s. There was a look of New Line movies. And I was totally. Just like, man, I missed that.
Well, that was, so you know more about this than I do. They started in sort of the horror genre. Is that kind of in the kind of like B schlocky kind of movie?
Yeah, because Nightmare was actually the first thing. There might be one thing, maybe I'm misremembering, but like ostensibly the first thing they produced and didn't just distribute was Nightmare on Elm Street, because Wes Craven, it's like, hey, you know, you got a new idea. Yeah, great. Let's make it.
Just looking at it now, what's interesting is they did some stuff before it. One is Alone in the Dark, which is, you know, kind of in this genre. Another one is Polyester, which I'm sure you guys are aware of.
John Waters
with the Odorama. Yeah. And it seems to me that their modus operandi, at least in the beginning, was doing the shit the other guys wouldn't.
Yep. Dead's another one, yeah.
Yeah, they took a lot of lumps because of it, and then they had up some really huge hits because of it. And I love this strategy in general. I think this is I think this is the way to go about building a company and just taking these, you know, there are the wild swings in terms of, you know, putting a lot of money on one number on the roulette wheel. But then, you know, these things that if Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles fails, like, that's such a black mark on your company. That's such an embarrassment. People might not ever want to work with you again. They're like, companies have been brought down by things like that all the time. You know?
Did you see that they released your one of your favorite films from 1989, Kenny?
1989.
Yeah. No Holds Barred, baby.
There you go. They're going the other way. We haven't done that one yet. I'm afraid to. That's a movie I'm very afraid to share with Phyllis Cove.
Oh, that is a movie that is going to lead to a great discussion, because I will tell you right now, it is aged like shit.
Oh, dude, it was shit when it came out. Like, it's
imagine how it feels 32 years later.
So when does, I mean, what would you say, because I'm skimming over their filmography, I guess, as a company. Is it like Dumb and Dumber was a big hit in 94. I feel like mid-90s is when they start to get, and I don't want to suggest that there's a illegitimacy to their earlier stuff, but you've got Seven in there, you've got sort of bona fides that are starting to materialize around that time.
I think that's what happens to a lot of these B-movie outfits when they start making money, is they start reaching for the legitimacy. Mm-hmm. And I mean, Seven is definitely one of those things. I mean, Dumb and Dumber is not a strain for legitimacy. I mean, it's a great movie, but it's not. But yeah, they're starting to push. And because the great fucking demon Harvey Weinstein fucked up and didn't get the rights to Lord of the Rings, they ended up becoming a mini major, basically.
Right. Because it's like, it feels like Austin Powers and Boogie Nights both in 97. Like, Boogie Nights to me feels like that's a huge one, right? Like, that's the big one. Yeah.
Because Austin Powers, like, you guys talked about it, I think, about how, like, it wasn't even that big. Yeah, it wasn't that big.
The first one was not that big.
No. It was all home video that saved that movie. So, again, New Line made money off of it because they wouldn't have made a goddamn sequel if they didn't. Right. But Boogie Nights was, definitely a big one. You know, getting all that Oscar play. I mean, they launched Fincher because the game is New Line also, right?
It's Polygram, actually.
No, is it?
Yeah. Well, but what's interesting too about New Line, not to get too nerdy, but like, they were also one of the first companies to like go all in on special features on their DVDs. Like, I felt like they went big time on that stuff. Like, I remember the Boogie Nights disc was just, you know what I mean? Same with Seven. Like,
these were
huge special features things. And I feel like that in the home video market kind of got them in a space to sort of compete with your Criterions and what have you on that level. But all of this is to say that, like, this movie feels kind of like, I can sort of see what they were going for. Like, it's pretty clear within the first 10 minutes, like, what this movie wants to be, but it's also clear why it will never get
there. Well, I mean, because this is that era where it's like, John Woo is in America, and oh man, we're getting Chow Yun-Fat, so we're going to start John Woo-ing up action movies, but all, like, so many of these action movies don't get the grace and the balleticism and like the rhythm and the tone, and like, they just don't get the tone that only John Woo can make fucking Face Off. Like, that's like, it's an insane concept, but, and then you watch the movie and you're like, am I having a fever dream? Like, this is insane, but it works only because of this fucking maniac. That's his thing. He's not copying someone.
Well, there's a musicality to John Woo as well, and to all the, you know what I mean? Like, it is a ballet, as you said. And if you think it's just action, you've lost the thread. Like,
because his movies in Hong Kong were called Heroic Bloodshed. It was like Brothers Bound in Blood, because it was all about this hyper masculine but like emotional brotherhood thing, where either they're on the same side and they become brothers, or like the killer, it's like a hitman and a cop, and they have to team up and they realize they're friends, better friends than anyone on their own team. And that's kind of what this is trying to do, because in the end there's the betrayal, but then it's like, well, we actually like each other, and Chow Yun-Fat fucking dies to save Wahlberg, which is like, in a Wu movie, that would have been a big like moment. But it's kind of just like, wait, he's dead now?
You're tapping into something that I think is interesting, which is sort of the theatricality of those films versus this film. And I wanted to kind of hone in on the violence in this film, which is, this movie's really violent. And it's not violent in a way that is particularly, and I don't mean this to sound weird, but fun. Like, there's a theatricality to the way that John Woo's violence plays out, whereas this is like gritty and upsetting.
Well, that's the thing I was saying. The tone is trying to be like John Woo and fucking kind of Fincher or like Friedkin or something. If you're doing that kind of big violence, like, I think the midpoint chase scene is actually pretty great.
Yeah, I do too.
But if you're not like as desensitized to movie violence as I am, and all of these civilians are just getting mowed down during the shootout, which I think is actually pretty a good like element to the scene, because it just adds a weight to shit, and you don't see that often, but like, there's the realistic squibs. Especially, and honestly, especially today. I mean, like, it's a mass shooting. People feel weird.
But even then, you're hitting on something that I think that Foley just missed, which is, you know, I just watched The Getaway, right? That's Peckinpah. And Peckinpah has you can't get lost in the Peckinpah sauce if you're paying attention, right? If you're paying attention, it's very clear that he's not glorifying violence. For instance, there's a scene in The Getaway where two or three civilians get shot on, you know, a quiet street. And he cuts away at least three times to child bystanders watching this happen in the moment and their faces. Yeah. And it's subtle enough where you're not insulted. But it also, you know, it really doesn't, you see what he's doing very clearly. It's very clear what's happening here. And I think that's completely lost in this movie. You fall into the Zack Snyder situation, and I know you like Zack Snyder, and I like Zack Snyder too, but you fall into the Zack Snyder situation where it's almost like ask for forgiveness, not permission, right? Which is that's what Man of Steel felt like to me, right? Like, at the end of that film, he's like, this next film's going to be an apology for that. But he certainly didn't, in the moment, understand what he was doing with Man of Steel. He just wanted to blow as much shit up and create as much.
I disagree with a lot of people's views of the ending of Man of Steel. That's another discussion for another. I just think the movie is about the first day of Superman. And if you watch the end of the movie, Superman's not actually destroying anything. He's getting his ass kicked by a general who's actually a fighter. And Clark Kent's a doofy fucking farm boy who's never been in a fight in his life. And you watch it, Zod's taking him by the cape, swinging him into buildings, knocking him across town. The only blows Superman lands is like when he's there above the city and he's punching him across the city, and then he takes him into space.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. I mean,
I've been dealing with Man of Steel for goddamn 10 years, so I know this shit. I'm going to write a dissertation about this.
No, but Tom, I'm a fucking doctor. I think both of these things could be true. Right? Yeah. Like, I think what you're saying can be true, while I think Snyder is also not dealing with the amount of violence and destruction that's caused until the next film.
But I think that's a fair tack to take for a movie. I think the bigger problem
only
is
if you
that
know
Batman
there's gonna be
Superman,
a next film.
But I think
which
I mean,
I guess
there's a
you
lot
do,
of movies
but...
where you can but the bigger problem is that Batman vs. Superman kind of takes that task, but also is so busy trying to do the DCEU expansion shit
it's a
lot of it get. And I like Batman vs. Superman, but again, that's a whole other discussion. But yeah, to your original point, if you're either going to be Sam Peckinpah or you're going to be John Woo or Paul Verhoeven, like you see the squibs John Woo or Paul Verhoeven use, you're just like, oh, this is not real. This is fucking, what are people made out of jelly donuts? No, this is nonsense. So I can just unwind and just let the mayhem unfold upon me. But if you're going Peckinpah, like nobody's watching The Wild Bunch going, hell yeah, I want to be in that Mexican village right now mowing people down. I want to be in that bank, the infamous opening of The Wild Bunch. If they move, kill them. Like this isn't like you gotta have the right tone. And, you know, for a lot of people, you know, even me, I kind of like this movie for what it's worth, mainly because of Chow Yun-Fat. But
he's really good in this. I mean, I really liked him in this. And I mean, ultimately, my issues with the film really have more to do with what you're saying in terms of tone and also, yeah, go ahead.
I didn't really like him. You guys liked him?
I liked him in this.
I didn't.
I think he's the only one who knew the tone of the movie he was in.
I agree with that.
I guess.
He's having fun.
I guess.
But also because he's done this 100 times before. Yeah. I mean, this is.
I just feel like it's the Foley Wahlberg 1-2 punch that really kind of derails the film, in my opinion. Like the tone is all over the place. I also just think that, you know, there's something about a white guy making this movie that just sort of also just feels very just not okay.
I don't even necessarily know if it's about that it's a white guy. It's just that it's a white guy that didn't do his homework. He just took it as a job and didn't pay it with the respects. Like, I got Ali on my TV now, and like nobody's mad when Michael Mann makes these things outside of his realm. Like, he's making a movie and he's making a TV show in Tokyo for HBO right now. Nobody's going to get mad when that comes out because you're going to be like, this fucking lunatic did his homework.
That's what
they
you
might
hear
get mad
a lot.
That Ansel Elgort's in it, but you know, sorry, Ken.
Well, no, that's what you hear a lot. I mean, I think that's right. I think there is a responsibility to do your homework. Mm-hmm. And I think as a person who's, you know, not the same race, same ethnicity as your characters, you do have that responsibility, but you kind of always should. This shouldn't really be a new thing.
I agree.
So, yeah, you can still make movies about anyone, Phil.
Yeah, I guess I don't disagree with what you guys are saying. I think you feel that he didn't do his homework is kind of what I'm saying. It feels because, like someone that's not.
Well, because I think the main problem is that it's so heavily Chinese, like there's so much Chinese society and just like these little things that like you. If he did his homework, or yeah, if you had someone from China or who grew up in Chinatown and had this background, they could have like really honed in and did all that shit. But it really just mainly feels like the movie version of like Chinese society and not like a well lived in society. But you know, that goes back to the tone thing.
Right.
You want to be a gritty, realistic thing?
Yeah,
it's kind of a pulpy script when all things are said and done, and yet it's directed in a way that doesn't.
I mean, because for whatever flaws Kenny has about The Departed, that movie at least knows to be like crank everything up to 11, keep moving, like don't go for gritty realism. Where this is like, all right, we're gonna start with Chow Yun-Fat assassinating some gang members in a in an antique shop.
This is
definitely a better movie than The Departed. The Departed is definitely a better movie than this.
Tom was like, wait a second.
The Departed is definitely better than the Corruptor. The only difference is the Corruptor never won Best Picture.
This is true.
That's my big difference between these two.
Yeah, very true. I don't know if you guys knew that. It didn't win Best Picture.
Of course, The Departed is fine as a film.
It just should not have been Scorsese's win. Yeah, of course.
Although fine.
It was his best movie that decade. That's my hot take.
That's just colossally untrue.
What's
better than The Departed that decade? Was Gangs of New York better?
The Aviator's better.
No, it's not. The Aviator's his second worst movie.
I don't disagree.
Ever made?
Thoroughly disagree with you.
Only thing worse is New York, New York.
Sure.
I think the Aviator he's not the right guy to have done it. It should have been Michael Mann or Nolan. And Leo is embarrassingly bad in that movie.
Listen, I'm not going to sit here and say that The Aviator is one of Scorsese's best films. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that in a decade of, you know, I like Shutter Island. I think Hugo is interesting.
You got the wrong decade for Hugo. He only this is a bad take, Tom. This take is cheating because he only made three movies in this decade.
Oh, what were the three movies?
You said them already. It's Gangs of New York, Aviator, and The Departed. So
it was.
If you want to say these are the best movie of the decade, even though it's the third best, that's fine. But these aren't top tier, top shelf Scorsese.
That's honestly his worst decade, in my opinion. It's his worst decade.
Well, he made nothing. I mean, in the subsequent decade, he made Shutter Island, he made Hugo, he made Wolf of Wall Street, Silence, and The Irishman. So. He it's just a bad decade of filmmaking.
But here's the thing about The Departed in comparison to this film, which is kind of an unfair comparison. We're comparing James Foley to Martin Scorsese. But like the thing about The Departed is it owns its silliness. And I think Kenny, your beef with it, and it's completely fair, is that it kind of doesn't make any sense. Like it's an illogical movie.
My beef is definitely that it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
My other beef is it owns its silliness when it wants to own its silliness. And it's fucking
serious when it wants to be
dead serious when it wants to be dead serious. And that drives me fucking up the wall.
This movie, however, does not own its absurdity when it comes to its story, like in terms of its plot. And that kind of drove me a little bit crazy.
Yeah, I think one of the big things that fucks up the tone and like it, where it doesn't know what it's trying to do is this shit with the FBI agent.
Yeah.
Where it's like, it's adding this like crazy weight to like everything.
I love that guy.
Well, I love him.
No, he's great.
Paul Ben Victor. Yeah. No, I
hear Greek.
Him.
Yeah. But it's just like, oh, we're coming for Chow Yun-Fat. And you got one of my guys killed. And now we're going to go for Chow Yun-Fat. But oh no, Marky Mark, you're an IA guy. You better tell me when you're going to tell him you're undercover. I want to see his face. It's like, hey, come on. Like, this is too much. This is a fucking stupid movie. You're adding way too much like geopolitical weight to this fucking thing. Which is
I agree. Can we talk for a second about Brian Cox in this and his
Do you think he remembers he's in this movie?
No. Here's a question, Kenny.
It's interesting how long Brian Cox has looked 70.
Yes. Do you think Brian Cox remembers being in this film more or less than The Minus Man?
Yeah. I think this one more because I didn't even remember he was in The Minus Man until you just said it. And I think we just did that. Brian, it's so interesting to me the way Brian Cox just kind of got lost in Hollywood for about 20 years and also was willing to do anything that was presented to him. And I think he always did a great job. He does a great job in this. I think he's north of 75 now. Finally found his signature role. That's so crazy and
it's
weird.
It's crazy. It's awesome though. He's so good. This performance and this role or this storyline between him and Mark Wahlberg, it kind of reminded me a little bit of him in 25th Hour.
Yeah, me too.
Which is a vastly superior film. I love that movie and I love him in it. Are you? What are your thoughts on 25th Hour, Tom? I couldn't tell if you were.
Oh, no, I love 25th Hour. Yeah, no.
There's something very sort of, it feels like, to your point, Kenny, that Brian Cox for years, decades even, seemed to play the kind of grizzled blue collar kind of Irishman thing, you know what I mean? And then, and now he is like the richest, yeah, the most, like, it's just interesting how it's all kind of turned on itself, because in this, he's this down on his luck guy who owes money to people.
It's so weird.
And now,
put a beard on the man and he's the richest man in the world.
It's great.
I think that was the trick he needed to figure out earlier in his career. He needed a beard.
You know,
because he doesn't really look like Brian Cox in this movie. Like,
no, he doesn't.
You think of Brian Cox, you think of him with a beard. Yeah. I mean, shit, Mel Gibson figured it out in Braveheart. Slap a beard on this fucking guy and you got a star.
Some guys have not great faces and need beards. You know, the biggest one for me.
You're talking to one.
I'm talking is Tom Lorenzo.
Tom Lorenzo's one.
Always been the big guy who needs a beard. But the big one for me is, all right, so Phil, remember in West Wing? Well, I just blew it. Remember in Force of Nature when we saw Toby without his beard, Richard Schiff without his beard?
Richard Schiff without a beard is wrong.
He's nobody. He's nothing. He's nobody. He's a schmuck on the street. He's a low status zilch. Throw a beard on the guy and he can run the planet. You know,
and you know who's also falls into that category a little bit? Paul Giamatti.
Much, much more authoritative with a beard.
Right?
Yeah.
Who's worse with a beard aside from Michael Phelps?
Who's worse with a beard?
Good question.
Oh boy.
I don't know.
You know who doesn't look great with a beard? Who rocks a beard when he's losing his mind? Is Jim Carrey better without a beard?
Yeah, but definitely
better. Oh, yeah. He looks like a guy that's really going to be a bother like 2 a.m. in New York City.
That's right.
Yeah. Has Wahlberg rocked a beard?
Yeah, Perfect Storm. What's it?
Isn't he? Yeah, he has one in the Huckabee.
No,
I think he's got a beard, doesn't he?
What's this fucking soldier movie with Peter Berg? Not
Lone Survivor.
Lone Survivor. I love that movie, and yeah, I forgot the name because I'm a dummy. But yeah, Lone Survivor. Yeah. He's got one.
I'm looking at his Perfect Storm beard right now. So Wahlberg clearly can't grow a beard, and I love that him. I love that he's got that patchy beard. You know, Clooney looks fucking great in a beard too.
He's got a good beard in that movie.
Yeah,
too. Yeah. There's a lot of beards in Perfect Storm. It's mostly beards.
Clooney, good looking guy. Who knew?
Who knew?
I'm without the beard too.
You know who doesn't look good with a beard? Damon.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Yeah. No, I agree with you on that.
Watching these trailers for Stillwater, I'm like, this looks like an SNL sketch.
Same with Last Duel. He looks fucking ridiculous.
That's
a
funny beard. I like that looking. I told you I liked. Oh, no. Damon looks ridiculous. Affleck's
you're
beard.
You're talking about Affleck beard.
The other guy with the beard that I think I like, that I think is not a great beard look is who the fuck was I gonna say? I can't remember, but I'm sure it was interesting.
I'm sure it was great.
I want to talk for a second.
DiCaprio, don't love him with a beard.
He doesn't look good with a beard. Although no. Revenant, he didn't look terrible with that kind of weird, scraggly, crazy beard. Didn't look terrible.
Yeah.
He doesn't look terrible. Hardy's a good beard guy.
Sure, sure.
You know who's good? Denzel's I like with a beard.
Denzel's got a good beard. You know, Will Smith doesn't look great with a beard.
Guy. These are goatee guys you're talking about.
No, but like if you see him in Virtuosity or like Safe House, when he's playing like I haven't shaved in 2 years because I'm undercover or I'm in jail. He's got
Denzel have a beard in Training Day?
He's got a goat in Training Day.
He's got a goat.
You know, actually, goat. Kenny, the answer to your question.
Oh, God, he looks good with a goatee.
The person who looks better. Worse with a beard, and it's usually because it's a fake beard, is Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
Because
Tom
I don't
Cruise
know
does not have authority with a beard.
Can he grow a beard like that?
I don't know.
Brad Pitt might look better with a beard.
Yes.
Oh, he looks like, he looks great with a goat in Killing Them Softly.
Sure.
You want to know, man? Google Cruise with a beard. He could look real good with a beard.
Really?
Yeah.
Like, hold on a second.
Sometimes he really could pull it off. I kind of like the look.
Stop it. Really? Oh, you know what? You're right. Last Samurai's a good beard.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not I take bad, it back. Yeah. You're right. Yeah. He can. Yeah. I guess you're right.
Who knew?
But I don't think
he... I'm just pulling up this pic where he looks like a fucking psychopath.
That's full Scientological.
Yeah, that's too much.
That's I'm going to eat your kidneys.
I guess you're right. He's not bad with a beard. I take it back. Cruise with a beard. Who knew? So I want to just talk for a second because I do feel like there's this underlying theme in this movie that kind of needs to be unpacked a little bit, which is I'm not even really entirely sure how it fits into the story, but there's this prisoner component to this movie, people being locked in basements.
That human trafficking storyline.
Human trafficking storyline that I'm just like, I don't really know what you're... I mean, obviously they're against it, but I'm just like, I don't fully understand what you're saying.
Human trafficking, not pro.
Human trafficking, I'm against.
but then you've also got like the sex trade, which is playing into this as well, right? You've got this weird massage sequence to Madonna's Candy Perfume Girl.
This is the kind of movie that the Asian community points to when they call out and say these are the roles and the kind of movies that have been made about Asian Americans for the last, you know, forever many years, and you know, it exists, and here it is, and it's terrible. It's a really terrible film.
I think to Kenny's point, if you had an Asian guy as the Wahlberg character, it would alleviate a lot of issues because then you have the kind of the moral balance to the movie where it's like here's like a good Asian guy and here's Chow Yun-fat as the morally compromised but ultimately good Asian guy. And then you're surrounded by the criminals instead of just there's no morally upright Asian in the movie.
And furthermore, which like isn't necessarily a terrible thing, right? But you eliminate if Wahlberg's character is played by an Asian guy or a Chinese guy specifically, you eliminate the stuff that is the most horrible about it, which is this underlying thing that Asian people in America represent this forbidden exotic fruit. He keeps getting accused of having quote unquote yellow fever. He gets asked if he has an Asian, if he used to have an Asian girlfriend. He gets accused of only being there because he wants to have sex with Asian women. It's because their women are so hot and their hands are so small. And it's all these things that otherizes Asians, Asian Americans mostly, in a way that to me kind of overpowers anything else they're doing in this movie. It's totally unnecessary.
It feels like the movie's trying to get ahead of the criticisms.
Yes.
And try to make jokes about it. And it's like, oh, yeah, because you think us all as Chinese guys got tiny dicks. It's like, okay, I mean.
Yeah.
then you end the movie with like you said, like, why did they send a white guy undercover in Chinatown? Where it's just like, somebody knew this was stupid.
It's amazing that it's his dying words. Like, it's one thing for someone to point so this weird. Out early and be like,
which
you know
they
what?
Do. They do point it out early, but
yeah, it's still ridiculous.
To have not explained over the course of the movie why you sent a white guy into Chinatown is a big failure of the movie.
And also, like, again, this may be a little nitpicky. Why you're sending a guy to undercover who's so clearly compromised because his father's a degenerate gambler and hawk to the Italian mob? Seems like a thing you don't want your undercover agents to have in their background. But hey, maybe I'm nitpicking. I don't know.
Can we talk about, for a quick second, Mark Wahlberg's disgusting tattoo? Did you notice his tattoo in this film?
I noticed it, but I can't remember it now. But what
it's
was it
necklace.
Again?
It's a necklace. It's
Is that his real tattoo?
I don't know if it's real or not.
I don't think it is.
It's a necklace around his neck that goes down his stomach. It is truly repulsive. Like, it is a really bad tattoo.
It was his actual tattoo.
Seriously?
Yes. It was his actual tattoo. Ugh. And I think he's since had it removed. But yes, it's a real tattoo. Ugh.
That is 100% a trash boy in the 90s would have.
It's
good
so
God.
Awful. It's a really I thought it was a joke.
And I mean, I guess, you know, this is kind of the point where I don't know, maybe we kind of need to get into the whole Mark Wahlberg committed a hate crime against an Asian man thing.
Yeah, we should probably talk about that for a second.
Because it's like, yeah, that's kind of the tattoo you'd expect a guy who commit a hate crime against an Asian guy in Boston to have.
Yeah.
But it's kind of one of those things where it's like, I don't know, do you like judge the art, not the artist? But when it's like something this connected to the artist, it's like, fuck, how do I not talk about?
No, he's and by he, I mean, Mark Wahlberg has really sort of tried to deal with his sins in some form or another. He's become quite religious over the last, you know, 5 to 7 years or so, maybe longer.
Forever. I mean, he was it was well known. He went to church every Sunday and was very religious.
Okay.
That schedule of his that's been posted online is like daily routine where he wakes up at 4, prays for 2 hours. I guess he's trying to atone for his sins, I guess.
But then
he also did that kind of skeezy thing of trying to get the arrest expunged from his record, where it's like, I mean, dude, like, you're not going to fucking apply for work at McDonald's, and the fact that you're a felon is going to affect your life. Just own it. Fucking own it.
Yeah, totally. What were you saying, Kenny?
I'm a little compromised when it comes to Wahlberg, obviously. So I can't. I don't feel like I could talk all that like freely about it, not because I know anything else, but because, like, look, I know him and I respect him. He was a good boss and a good guy in a, you know, weird situation. It was fucking horrible. Obviously, it was horrible, horrible, horrible. And, you know, having someone like that, you know, he's not in my life in any capacity now. It hasn't been for about 15 years. But having someone like that, you know, and kind of see who he is in real life, it's real hard for me to even marry those two things in my head. What can I say? It fucking sucks. He was a really shitty kid, like, very clearly. He was a really bad person.
I guess it just kind of goes to the thing of, like, I mean, you worked with him and I haven't heard anything like really bad about him as a professional. So it's like, dude probably changed. More likely than not, he matured, grew up, he became a real man. And it just does add maybe you should have a little more self-awareness not to like jump into projects like this with your history. But it was 99. I mean, nobody was really talking about that shit. There wasn't Twitter that was going to blast him out of the water every time he did it. But
he totally should have been. I totally agree that he should have been a little more aware when it came to a role like this. I also think, you know, he's kind of avoided any social repercussions or career repercussions because this has always been out there. and this has been dealt with to some extent, or at least discussed to some extent. And he has, you know, at least acknowledged what he did and how terrible it was.
And he was a kid. I mean, let's also, not a kid, but like he was is before he was in the industry. So it's like, what do we do with the guy who's matured since he made those mistakes and then entered the industry? It's like, I don't know. I mean, these conversations
it's very are not complicated.
Easy.
You want there to be a certain amount of grace where you allow someone to change, you allow someone to get better. And I think we have. I think actually he's an example of society allowing him to kind of move on. And I do think that rubs a lot of people the wrong way, that Wahlberg, you know, handsome white guy from Boston, got the ability to, you know, kind of prove he's a better person. And a lot of other people don't. So,
yeah, I mean, and I think I agree with what you guys are both saying, that you know, this is at a time in his career and a time as a person where he, you know, had not sort of perhaps figured out who he was and the type of person he wanted to be. And, you know, in terms of atoning for his sins and what have you. So this is just a weird choice, I guess, is basically the best way to put it.
As a weird choice.
It's for a myriad of reasons, by the way. I mean, this is we all agree this is not a good movie. This is just, you know, it's the other question you have to wonder too is, you know, Foley does direct him in Fear. You know, as I mentioned earlier, it was supposed to be Ethan Hawke who was going to play the role, and then when Ethan Hawke couldn't, you know, I imagine that Mark Wahlberg was like, listen, I worked with this director before, I liked that experience, I want to work with him again, and perhaps that clouded his perspective on whether or not the subject matter was appropriate.
And honestly, just looking at that New Line slate for 99, it honestly just probably felt like this movie was kind of forgotten, sort of like
it is. Well, I mean, we're making movie it doesn't exist,
but just like even in the making of it, just like, yeah, we'll make it. You know, we got Chow Yun Fat, that should probably be enough to get people going in a you know, an overestimation of America's, you know, John Woo, Chow Yun Fat fever, because
sure. I mean, the next year we do have, you know, Crouching Tiger, which comes out in 2000, which feels like a little bit of a reinvention to some degree or another. It's a softer Chow Yun Fat, to say the least. It's a much more sort of emotionally fraught movie,
but also kind of back in easier territory for him.
Yes,
he's not, you know, speaking in English, trying to be an American, well, an Asian American, you know, immigrant cop dealing with all this shit. I mean, he's back in Hong Kong. It's ostensibly a Hong Kong movie that somehow fucking exploded in the box office. And then he's going back to doing nonsense like Bulletproof Monk.
Yeah. Right. It also doesn't so much feel like a Chow Yun Fat movie. It feels like the gravitas he has in America was being co-opted for that film. Him and Michelle Yeoh both. Now, I'm not saying they were massive stars, but they were probably the biggest stars from Hong Kong cinema, you know, with the exception of like Jackie Chan, who could be in that movie. And that was important, I think. It was important, you know, for Ang Lee and for that film to make it essentially a star-studded film. Because that film couldn't have skated by just making no dent. That was a big budget, big swing. Intended to be for you know, a global audience.
I watched it relatively recently, and I mean, that movie floors me. I mean, it's a stunning film from credits to credits, and watching it and I don't know, not to go down the whole Oscar rabbit hole, but like the idea that Gladiator beats Crouching Tiger for Best Picture is an insane thing to me. But I mean, it is what
it is.
I mean,
that's essentially like a Ridley Scott kind of like good job, buddy, like awards situation. I mean, because also Ridley was kind of fucking useless since Blade Runner. Like, you look at his...
I don't think that's fair, but I hear
well,
you.
Well, as you've put it so eloquently on the podcast, I'm an iconoclast, and I'm going to say he's been fucking useless since Blade Runner.
Sure. Yeah. You want to corrupt this podcast, I get it.
I'm a corrupter, baby. Like, you look at his filmography. Wait, he's making shit like Legend, Black Rain. I mean, other than Thelma and Louise, where there's this one blip where everyone goes, oh, yeah, Ridley Scott's a filmmaker. Then he Ridley goes back to white. Oh, White Squall. Everyone's running around town, going down to their watering hole, all pent up with energy because of White Squall. Or what about his Christopher Columbus movie with Gerard Depardieu?
He's not wrong, Joel. I mean, look at this shit.
I'm looking at his filmography right now.
It is a disaster between Blade Runner. It's a disaster between Blade Runner and Gladiator, with the exception of Thelma and Louise, like you said.
Which is crazy. I think that we have not watched Black Rain yet for 1989, but we might be surprised by Black Rain, but we also might not be. It's hard to say.
Legend is
Legend, for the record, was a movie. It was a flop, but like, from a technical, I mean, that movie is a stunning piece of filmmaking, whether or not you like the movie.
That's always with Ridley. We see it today. He makes a piece of shit like Prometheus, but you still get blinded by the production design. I mean, that's the guy's thing. I've said it to people, he's not too dissimilar from fucking like Zack Snyder. You're going to get a good looking movie, but sometimes he doesn't understand his scripts.
I'm just to be abundantly clear, I'm not saying that Ridley Scott doesn't have a hit or miss filmography. He very much does. And by the way, this year alone, we are getting the gamut of Ridley Scott. We are getting an overcooked medieval movie that you probably shouldn't make, and a straight up like campy Gucci biopic. Like, it's just, I mean, I'm, yeah, great. I don't have a problem with Ridley Scott, but I also think that like, I think The Martian's a lot better than it got kind of, you know,
I love the Martian.
Fun of it. I like The Martian. The whole comedy nomination for Golden Globes is unfortunately weirdly going to be one of the things it's remembered for.
That is so weird. I think The Martian's great and exactly the kind of movie that I want people to see and champion.
Yes.
Yeah, I think The Martian's great. I love American Gangster. I think Kingdom of Heaven Director's Cut is one of the best movies I've ever seen.
I think Mastic Men's a good movie.
Mastic Men's great. I mean, after Gladiator, he went on a hell of a run. Quite the opposite of the run he went on after Blade Runner.
And Phil and I both love Black Hawk Down too. I love Black Hawk Down. It's interesting that after Gladiator is when he kind of took off, and I don't think anyone thinks of that way. I certainly didn't until 1 second ago. But it also does belie the idea that Gladiator was a good job Oscar. Gladiator was a stupid Oscar. I don't know what happened that year.
Yes.
I've always thought it never made any sense to me. They already gave Braveheart the Oscar 5 years earlier, which is, you know, the same idea. He didn't win Best Director that year. Soderbergh won for Traffic. Yeah.
Traffic should have won Picture or Crouching Tiger.
Well, no, I mean, I think Traffic sucks too, but I think Crouching Tiger is the movie that I think Ang Lee's gotten robbed a bunch of times, but I think Crouching Tiger is the movie that really kind of matters from that year.
I just don't think America was ready for a foreign language movie to win. I mean, we just had one last year. I mean, so.
I mean, and then you got Brokeback 2, where it's like America.
That one pisses me off. Because that's my favorite Ang Lee movie. I love that fucking movie.
It's a great movie. It's a great movie.
And even in 2006, when I was a dopey little high school kid who, you know, it has to be said, we in high school, you use the derogatory F word for gays. It's just like you're just spouting off oxygen. And I was still pissed off about it. I was like, what the fuck? This is the best movie of the year. What are you doing? Look, come on.
We haven't really talked about Brokeback much, but I was, for whatever reason, my family went to Telluride 2 years to the film festival. Mm-hmm. And I was embarrassed to walk into that theater and with my parents and didn't want to like even be involved, and walked out fucking sobbing. And I think that movie did have a much bigger impact on the culture at large than people give it credit for. Yeah. I mean, I know it had a big impact within the industry and, you know, the kind of opening this space up, but a lot of people saw it and were able to understand homosexual relationships in a way I don't think people got before seeing that film. In different ways, homosexual relationships in film have always kind of been urban, mm-hmm. right? Urban or these sneaky suburban stories that are kind of like embarrassing. But this really opened up the world to other, you know, to other expressions of a homosexual love story. And I was really, I still think it's one of the best films ever made. I think it's maybe the best film of that decade. Yep. And obviously it should have won, and everyone knew it at the time.
It's an amazing thing. They did, I mean, as obviously, you know, Kenny and you, Tom, know that, you know, Blank Check did an Ang Lee miniseries. And when you see the moves of that career, it's just, I mean, it really is an incredible, to go from
he's the best.
Crouching Tiger to Hulk to Brokeback Mountain in three moves shows how fearless this guy is. I mean, I remember, obviously, Hulk was a big disaster in terms of its box office, what have you. And I remember reading in the trades that his next film was going to be a film about a gay love story about two cowboys. And I was like, this is a bad idea. Like, don't do this.
Well, that was Brokeback Mountain was also it was a novella. It was a big novella.
Yes, yes. Like, and I don't mean to suggest don't do this deal. As in we shouldn't make this. I just was like, no, that seems risky.
Dude, it was a crazy thing at the time. Yeah, people. Yeah. It was a crazy thing to have those actors play those roles. And
I mean, because I say this shit all the time. I'd get into it with people I used to work with at the Alamo who don't really like to remember how things used to be. Like, it's kind of crazy that only like what 5-6 years after Brokeback comes out, gay marriage is legalized.
It's not a coincidence.
Would we have thought a year before Brokeback came out that gay marriage was not only legalized within our lifetimes, but within a decade, less than a decade?
It's crazy.
No.
Yeah. I mean, fucking Obama had to run as an anti-gay marriage president and then immediately said, surprise, suckers. And
but it's very true. It's really interesting.
One other thing about Ang Lee, because he's kind of the opposite of this conversation of James Foley with this movie in some way, in terms of a guy who does his homework. Ang Lee was, you know, not born in America. I know he went to college in America, but he wasn't born in America. And some of these films, specifically,
Goddamn American.
Brokeback is so American. Ice Storm is so American. Ride with the Devil is so American. Taking Woodstock, like different Billy Lynn's, the different aspects of America that he gets so perfectly. And it's so clear. He just immerses himself in whatever world. And I'm blown away by the way he just challenges himself every time.
And it's the thing about different. I mean, it's the thing I said earlier. It's that he's a guy with a vision. And even if you can't look at one movie to the next and be like, the same guy made these two movies? Because like you watch Ride with the Devil, then you watch Hulk and you go, what happened? But he's a guy with a vision.
Ride with the Devil. We still haven't covered it yet on 99. I'm excited to do it.
I gotta watch it again. I haven't watched it in a while. I thought it was good, but I might have been a little too young to kind of wrangle with its political and societal.
And I think its casting is a little spotty. I know that you know there's people that questioned some of the casting. So
he took a shot. You know what I mean? Like,
that's what the guy does.
You never know if it's going to be Lady Gaga or Jewel. But
my only thing with Aang is I want him to get out of the technical fucking hole he's found himself in with I'm going to do frame rate. It's like it looks awful. Stop.
I'll say this. I saw Gemini Man in high frame rate 3D. It's not a good movie. I'm not riding for it. But there's some technical stuff in there that's just pretty fucking breathtaking.
I think the action sequences benefit from not being in high frame rate because there are so many bits in the action sequences where I'm just like, yeah, this is clearly like not happening on the set. Yeah. It's my thing with high frame rate is, you don't have to do it. Nolan figured out the trick. It's IMAX cameras. Bigger, clearer, like you want it to be, but it still looks like film. It's not like you're hanging out at a Best Buy all day. I don't know. That's just
me. I hear that. Do we want to rate this movie?
I don't know. Do
Kenny?
We?
Yeah.
So I watched this yesterday. I didn't like it very much. But I also was like, I couldn't decide if it was... I mean, I was kind of bored. I wouldn't recommend this film necessarily, but I was kind of like, is this like below 50 or above 50? I kind of was on the fence about it. I kind of was in the sort of low 50s. This conversation has dropped it down. I'm in sort of the low 40s now. I think I'm at like a 42. There is some competence there. It's not like a fucking total turd of a movie. You know what I mean? There is some, I actually do like some of the cinematography in it. I think some of it looks actually kind of cool at times. As we mentioned, Chow Yun-fat's really good in it. I would say by and large, most of the Asian actors, like the Asian component of this film is actually, is not necessarily the problem, the representation of it. It's not the performances that are necessarily the issue. You know, so yeah, I'm at like a 42. Where are you at, Kenny?
I'm a little lower. I mean, what I said was this is an ugly looking, too loud, too reliant on gunplay movie.
Sure.
I thought it was the worst of the 80s and the worst of the 90s. It's just it just took the stuff from 80s action and 90s action that I don't like and didn't have any of the stuff I do like. Look, I had it at 25 before this. I'm not going to really go up or down. I don't think this conversation made me like it anymore, but I certainly don't like it any less.
Sure.
I'm going to stick it at 25. It is what it is.
You know, it's funny you talk about the 80s, 90s thing. Well, I forgot to say, but watching this movie, it felt like the precursor to those fucking Steven Seagal acts with the rapper movies.
Yeah.
Because I don't know why. Exit the way wounds. Some of the shots, the way they shoot like the coverage of the city with rap music, I'm like, why rap music? This is the Asian, this is the Hong Kong Chinese community. Why are you fucking playing?
There's a lot of fisheye wide angle lens stuff too.
He fucking watched Deli or some shit.
Yeah.
But that's what it feels like. It's he misrepresented the crime world he was dealing with. It's like, no, you're not dealing with black gangs. This is Asians. You do know Chow Yun-fat is Asian, correct? But also just a funny thing I noticed, the older boss there that is gets assassinated to like in this complicated, we're using the young guys to take over the mob thing.
Yeah.
His character's name is Uncle Benny. That guy was in Lethal Weapon 4 the year before playing a triad gang member named Uncle Benny. What a fucking hole to find yourself in America. I'm only playing triad gangsters named Uncle Benny from here forth.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Which kind of again goes to the thing of Hollywood fucks up Asian representation. You keep naming this one guy Uncle Benny. Not the best look. Then he just shoots himself in the head. Gotta get his that's pretty baller. It's pretty baller.
Yeah.
You're not gonna kill me. Just shoots himself.
What's your rating on this, Tom?
My rating did go down a little bit, but my level for recommendation, I go a little higher than you guys. I go 65 or above is my recommendation line. I grade like papers, like I said.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
I was beforehand like, this is good. Chow Yun-fat's great. I liked some of the action, like that chase scene in the middle is actually really great. I also really like the murky morality of the movie. Like, I kind of like it's making this point of like Chow Yun-fat's the more honorable guy because he's upfront with who he is, and Mark Wahlberg's kind of the fink who's like pretending to be a good guy. Yeah. Also, kind of like making the point of like most cop policing is just politics and just trying to rise up in the ranks. That's all Marky Mark's trying to do. He's trying to get promoted.
Sure. It's a good scene with his dad when he talks about that sort of duplicity and that duality. Yeah.
So I kind of like that murkiness to it, which a lot of cop movies don't really get into. But yeah, this conversation knocked it down for me. So I'm going to go just to the recommendation line of 65.
All right.
So I'd say if you like Chow Yun-fat, if you like semi-competent like pulp crime movies, this is not the worst one you could watch.
Should put that on the poster. Semi-competent.
This is not the worst one you could watch.
This is not the worst one you could watch. No.
Incredible. Well, Tom, always a pleasure having you here. I look forward to
Before we go, we have to play a game.
Oh, yes. Of course. My apologies. Yes.
All right. As our listeners know, Tom hosts the You're Missing Out podcast with Mike Natale. I looked it up and then I lost. Oh, I got it. Okay. And Phil and I are both going on for the second season after their very successful first season, which yielded a really great video you should watch. Has some really good audio
Yeah.
A really good audio bite from one of their guests.
The dulcet tones of Kenny Neibart.
That's right. I sound so smart in that. It's crazy. and we're both going on. So Phil already mentioned he's going on for All About Eve. And I wanted Phil to guess what I'm going on for. So Phil, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to read them off to you.
Please. Okay, great.
The films that entered into the National Film Registry in 1990, the second year. So it was Phil's choice, All About Eve, All Quiet on the Western Front, bringing up Baby, Dodsworth. You also tell me about Dodsworth, Tom. Mm-hmm. Duck Soup, Fantasia, The Freshman, The Godfather, The Great Train Robbery, Harlan County, USA, How Green Was My Valley, It's a Wonderful Life, Killer of Sheep, Love Me Tonight, Meshes of the Afternoon, Ninotchka, Primary, Raging Bull, Rebel Without a Cause, Red River, The River, Sullivan's Travels, Top Hat, Treasure Sierra Madre, and A Woman Under the Influence. Phil, what movie do you think I'm doing? And Tom, before the episode, told Phil that you would make a lot of money if you had bet on Kenny doing this film.
This is, okay, so like my gut is going in sort of the what is the most, sort of the least Kenny movie on this list. And I
chose this movie.
Okay.
Because it's a Kenny movie.
Oh.
Tom may just not real may not have realized.
No.
Okay. So
it's,
this
I'll say it's a Kenny movie that on its face you don't think is a Kenny movie.
Well, okay. So here's the thing. As our listeners know, Kenny contains multitudes. Okay. And by that I mean that Kenny can love Kenny does love wrestling and Kenny loves Bob Fosse. These are two things that he loves dearly, and they're very different things.
Two of the pillars of my personality.
Sure. I'm going to guess Top Hat.
Wow, Phil.
Boom. Got it.
Out of 25 choices, I guess 24 minus yours. That's amazing.
I went dancing.
As I said to Mike Natale, I'm a dance writer. I write on Step Up. And if anybody is experienced in the world of dance, it's me. So I thought it was appropriate for me to break down the dance. And meanwhile, I'm also like hounding Clay Keller to let me on his dance movie draft for.
It'll happen.
Yeah, apparently I'm on the list. But
I would love to end up on that show because, oh boy, putting me in a room arguing about movies with other people is always a good idea.
Have you listened to that show?
I love it, yeah. I'm not caught up. I listen to everything.
Right.
But I just
you and Mike should go up. On. You should
I wonder what you guys would do was going to be my question. Have you thought about it?
Yeah.
I can't believe you got Top Hat. I'm so impressed.
No, I haven't really thought about it. I'm sure fucking Mike's thought about it. But I think all the Disney shit's been covered by now. Because he's a Disney boy. I mean, I'm open to shit, man. I'm open to just being like, yeah, let's do this. I'll do my homework and I'll argue. Put me in a room with any of these guys and it'll be an argument for the ages.
We should find one of your enemies. I'm sure we can.
Oh my God. It'd be great. You and like Carrie Corrigan just going on and yelling at each other.
Hey, I'm ready to throw down.
Yeah,
oh, haven't been blocked by anyone since our last recording. So
there you
good.
Go. That's something. That's
progress. I've only been punched in the face in person.
Yeah, the day's still young. I can't wait to hear your episode on Top Hat, Kenny.
Yeah, likewise, yours on All About Eve.
I know
Emily Vanderwerf is going on for It's a Wonderful Life. Have you done that yet?
No, she's busy, and she's got a surgery coming up, so she doesn't want to overload too much. So it's going to be a September, October, sort of whatever when we figure all that out. But fall 2021.
That's great because she is
the best.
I think like obsessed with that movie. I think it's her second favorite movie. So
it's like her North Star.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to
it. I love that movie. Every time I cry.
I actually had never seen that film until two Christmases ago. I was home in Toronto and it was playing at a rep theater and I went to see it.
Oh, that's cool.
And it was great to see it on the big screen. That movie's kind of crazy. Great movie, but like kind of crazy.
You don't realize how dark it is. And you always forget how dark and hard it goes. And then you're like, oh shit, this movie's fucking got some balls.
It's got like serious magic realism going on. Like you're just like, it starts in the stars talking to each other. It's a weird movie.
But then it's also like 2 hours until Clarence shows up.
Yeah, it's great.
It doesn't. For whatever reason, you're right, obviously, but it doesn't feel like magic realism. It feels appropriate. It feels appropriate for the time and the Christmas setting.
I can't wait to talk about that movie. That movie is a movie that I call the movies that shouldn't work. It's like the best movie that shouldn't work because you describe it like you say, "Oh, the stars are talking." There's this little doughy guy. It's an angel. You spend 2 hours in this like gritty neo-realistic. Just misery fest about how capitalism sucks.
Then you're in a hellscape. Yeah.
So I don't know if you guys watched the Netflix series, The Movies That Made Us. Have you watched these by any chance?
I
know the series, but
there's only like 6 episodes, and it's basically just, you know, big movies from our childhood, you know, from the 80s and 90s and what have you. And they just released their second season. It's Back to the Future, Pretty Woman, Jurassic Park, and Forrest Gump are the 4 movies that they cover.
Never heard of them.
Yeah, I know. And I bring this up because I feel like Back to the Future is another one that shouldn't work. Like that's a movie that shouldn't work, and yet
it only works because it has a perfect script. I mean, that script should be taught in fucking film schools. Just like literally, just everything perfectly placed, paid off later. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's a perfect film. And we talked with Emily on our Patreon about Back to the Future Part 2 recently.
That's right, yes. I saw the schedule. Yeah,
And that'll be going up in a week or so. That series is fascinating. But Back to the Future is one of those movies that goes on the list of this should
absolutely
work.
Absolutely not work. So many. About a mom who wants to fuck her son.
So many great movies fall under the it shouldn't work. You know, so
yes, well, and even movies that I mean, I don't know that Tom's thoughts on this, but I don't imagine you're a big Forrest Gump fan.
I mean, I don't love it, but it's very watchable.
Right, I feel similarly.
Exactly where I sit.
but that's another
what
movie
a surprise
that also feels like. And watching last night, I would just watch the episode about it, and it's one of those films that, like, you know. Decades of development, a script in a box, people fighting for it, finally gets made. But then, like, you know, Zemeckis and Hanks both have to basically punt all of their upfront money into the back end. And it's just one of those movies that's like, it's a weird movie to go all in on and could have easily gone the other way and it would have been a disaster. But instead, it's a beloved movie. But anyway, Tom, thank you so much for coming on.
I love talking
this podcast
to you guys.
With us.
I always corrupt this podcast. That's what I do.
And I look love forward to finding another action movie. There are still a few left.
Well, listen, I'm always here to talk about action movies, but I'm the horror movie guy. You got to get me on for horror stuff.
Well, this is actually, I want to ask you this, Kenny, because I know Kenny's been trying to get me to watch more horror movies to quote unquote be brave, like Rollin says, and watch more horror.
Brave.
Watch more horror movies. There are some deep cut horror films in 99. I was doing a little bit of digging, some sequels and what have you. Candyman 3, I believe, was a 99 film. I have not seen any of the Candyman films. I don't know
You're right.
Thoughts on the Candyman films?
Well, I've only seen the first one. I hear the second one's actually pretty good. Bill Condon directed it. That was one of his early movies. So I have it. I'm going to watch it before the new one comes out. But the first Candyman, depending on my mood, it's either the first or second best horror movie of the 90s.
Wow.
Okay. It's an unbelievable
I think Candyman's fantastic too. What's your other one?
Scream.
Okay.
Sure.
Scream, yes, but Scream almost isn't a horror movie to me. Like, it is, of course, but yeah, in terms of just like, you know, the pure shit, Candyman is pretty fantastic.
And Candyman is just so iconic, and Tony Todd is unbelievable. I think you'd actually love Candyman because it's not like Saturday matinee, fucking just teens getting slashed to death kind of shit, which I love, but
the new one looks really scary. The trailer's pretty fucking intense.
I'm interested. I mean, because it's a sequel to the first one.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're not acknowledging two or three. So it's going to be like a sequel to the first one, which I'm intrigued by. Yeah. I really want to see it. Well, I can't wait.
We can talk Candyman 3, and there's others. So, you know, listen, you should do some digging, see if there's some horror films you want to cover. I'm open to doing it.
Candyman 3, I'm down to do. I'm going to watch all three of them before the new one. So, I'm down to do it. And also, for your podcast like it's 1989, there's the three big slashers.
Oh, we're doing it.
If
we get to 300 patrons, we're doing it.
Kenny wants you and Mike to come on and talk about those three slasher films.
Halloween 5, Nightmare 5, Jason Takes Manhattan. Guys, who doesn't want to watch those three movies and talk about them? Glorious cinematic treasure that is Jason in Vancouver, not Manhattan.
On a boat. Jason Takes Manhattan I've seen and I love. The other ones I haven't. So I would, I'd get real into
it. Halloween 5 is interesting to talk about because of how nonsense the production is. And I don't know. I don't like Nightmare 5.
I've definitely got to a place, Kenny, I think you'll be happy to hear, where it's like I'll put on a horror film in the afternoon with my blinds open and I'll watch it.
Yeah.
Also, we need to tell you, these movies are not scary. you're not going to have any issues with these fucking movies.
I agree. What does scare you, Phil? I feel like you've watched scarier movies than slashers. Slashers wouldn't scare you.
I think that
Halloween's might, but for the most part.
But not
I think
Halloween
part
fights.
Of it is, part of it's psychosomatic, right? Part of it is the fact that like I didn't watch them as a kid. They scared me as a kid. So I just didn't watch them. Slasher films, to your point, Kenny, I don't think slasher films actually would scare me. So I listen, if you put me in a movie theater and you're doing the jump scares, like I'm going to be anxious. That's a different animal than watching it on my TV screen at home. I don't know. I don't know what to say other than the fact that like I don't watch them because I've convinced myself that I can't watch them. And maybe that's just not a good reason.
That's why when I was a kid, I was terrified of horror movies. My older brother forced them on me and it fucked me up. But like at a certain point when I was like 13 or 14, I was like, I got to get over this shit. Like I love movies. I got to get over this. So I just kind of like forced myself to do it because you're an example, but you hear stories all the time of people that don't watch these things when they're kids and then they just can't do it when they're older because like they didn't prep themselves for it.
Yeah.
And I don't, if I ever have kids, I'm going to die alone, but like, that's another story. If I have kids, I want to like kind of prep them, maybe not as hardcore as I was as a kid, but like kind of like ease them in. Like, here's the Monster Squad. Here's when they're 12. Like,
I think that's what
Fear
Kenny's
Street.
Doing.
Oh, 12. I mean, it's so kid dependent, you know, it's weird how I obviously had plans and the plans, you know, go kaput as soon as you meet the kids.
Yeah.
But my, Rollins has been down to watch scary shit forever. And now he just wants to push it and push it and push it.
Right.
And Layla, my daughter, won't watch anything, you know, scarier than PG. And I can already tell Cole, the 4-year-old, he's scared by, you know, certain cartoons. So it's very kid dependent, but I agree with you. I mean, I really do think that horror movies serve a dual purpose of being great entertainment and also being like, you know, a way to confront your fears and desensitize yourself to a lot of that. I think it's very helpful. So,
I think if you're down for it, Kenny, maybe we do Candyman 3 to try to get it out before the Candyman movie comes out at the end of August.
I got to watch 1 and 2 again then, but I will.
Yeah, but we got time. We got a month. But
Candyman 3 is great. All right, let's do it.
All right, gentlemen.
All right.
Adios.
Later, Tom.
One last thing. Please rate, review, and subscribe. Speaking of subscribing, check out our Patreon on all the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Fabulous Baker Boys, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, Field of Dreams, Major League, and many, many more. We are covering all the best films of 1989 with amazing guests like Joanna Robinson, Liz Hanna, Hunter Covington, Brian Cogman, David Iserson, and many, many more. All your favorite guests from our 1999 podcast are coming on to the 1989 Patreon. You can sign up for it at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. For only $5, you get access to all of these awesome episodes. And for a few bucks more, you get video of our 1999 episodes as well. Plus, there are other very cool tiers too, where you can even be a guest on our podcast. Please check out our Reddit as well at reddit.com/podcastlikeits. We're also on Twitter at podcastlikeits1999. We're also on Instagram at podcastlikeits1999. Thank you so much to Ernie and Will for producing our episodes, Sullivan for our social media, Jan Katas for our amazing art and theme songs. And most of all, thank you all for listening.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.